Since the Confederation of Canada, and long before it, during the reign of New France and the later period of British conquest and colonization, policy towards First Nations people has oscillated between outright genocide and assimilation. Many would argue there's no difference between the two. Both are colonial, and both seek to eliminate Indigenous peoples as such. From more than a century of residential schools that claim the lives of tens of thousands of Indigenous children, to land claims processes that the federal government seems loath to resolve, the whole history of Canadian policy towards First Nations points in the direction of eliminating them as such, as nations. The policy of the current federal government under a Conservative majority is no exception to this long colonial history. The current federal government's approach is to abandon its commitment to past treaties under the banner of individual property rights. That is, to extinguish the collective rights to nationhood of Indigenous people by promoting individual property rights that would see reserves parceled out and to individuals according to a system known as fee simple. The lands would be municipalized, and the sovereignty of any given nation buying into the scheme would be effectively extinguished. In order to make this plan enticing, the federal government is willing to throw hundreds of millions of dollars at First Nations band councils to lure them into land claim surrenders. One such case in question, very close to us here in Toronto, is the Cold Waters Narrow land claim, which would give $307 million to the Chippewa Tri-Council and the Chippewas of Nawash to surrender the land. According to the federal government website detailing the claim, quote, in return for this compensation, the First Nations will provide Canada with a release of their claim to ensure certainty and finality. Settlements must bring closure for all concerned. But it goes on to say, open quote, First Nations can purchase lands on the open market and apply to have them added to the reserve. Close quote. On the line with us today are two Anishinaabeg activists who not only do not recognize the legitimacy of the Coldwaters Narrow land claim settlement, but have also been active in protesting the settlement through a land reclamation in Owenda Provincial Park, which is located at the top of the Penetanguishene Peninsula in Georgian Bay. They have also been touring Anishinaabeg communities to raise awareness around the land claim surrender process. Richard Peters and Johnny Hawk, welcome to the show.
Bonjour. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, just a very quick question to get us started. In the interest of, you know, promoting awareness of your people's struggle, can you explain for our listeners what range of peoples and First Nations communities fall within the Anishinaabeg Nation?
Well, that's kind of an answer we have to explain. There's two parts of that. Mm-hmm. The Anishinaabeg Nation, you know, there's confusion with that. There's 42 reserves, band reserves in Ontario that fall under the Anishinaabeg Nation. There's a Union of Ontario Indians, which are 42 band chiefs who are united to represent these their communities, their reserves. And as you know, reserves are governed by the Indian Act, who are accountable to the Crown, right, to the Canadian state. They're not accountable to the people. So the chiefs of Union of Ontario Indians have made a secretariat in 1949. And they called that the Anishinaabeg Nation. So they kind of misappropriated that name, Anishinaabeg Nation. So our nation, like what we understand and who we really are, is a nation that stretches our territory from what is now known as Quebec, the northwestern part. Some of them are referred to as the Algonquin people. Mm-hmm. There's the Mississauga people of who now reside in east of Toronto near Six Nations New Credit. But, the Odawa, Potawatomi, and the Ojibwe people, we have a confederacy. There's three fires, Anishinaabeg confederacy of those people who are predominantly Ojibwe, Odawa, Potawatomi. So our nation goes all the way to the beginning of the Rocky Mountain to the Minnesota, Michigan, and Manitoba, northern and central Ontario. So that's how far our nation stretches. And, we don't know those borders. Those borders are, not our what we follow under the this in the States are called, tribes and stuff like that. But, you know, those are other people's definition. So, there's two persons.
So can you explain some of the history behind this Cold Waters Narrow land claim and, what led to its negotiation, where it's at right now with the government, committing $307 million? In particular, I'm wondering how you would respond to the argument that, this deal has been negotiated by your leadership, so why don't you see it as legitimate?
with our beliefs, our clients, and what we're trying to do in this camp is trying to reestablish who we are as Anishinaabe people. We're trying to assert our sovereignty, so we're trying to reestablish our clan governance system, where, you know, our hereditary chief system, our clan mother system. You know, we have a people in our women in our clan system who give authority to the people to speak. You know, like such as chiefs or sub-chiefs or head people. So we're trying to reestablish that. And again, with these, to say that these people who are given power to represent these reserves and these people, like Anishinaabe communities, they're given power by the Canadian state, which is an illusion. These the very existence of the reserve system and the chief and council is not our original ways. That those ways are imposed on us. So for them to make in these deals is illegal. It's illegal in the eyes of Canada, and it's a breach. It's an act of treason to Canada, and it's an act of treason to our own people, right? Because they're upholding someone else's. So I would say to, like, first of all, these are the original agreements that we're trying to uphold, which is our nation-to-nation relationship, which is, you know, these peace agreements, which are based on non-interference and coexistence, you know, ultimately gave legitimacy for the Crown to be within our territories. So when they breach these agreements, you know, they're, what I mean by they're breaching their own constitution is when we became, you know, allies and established these peace agreements. Right after that, it led way for the Royal Proclamation, which, you know, the Crown gave rules to its subjects on how to conduct themselves within our territories, which ultimately, you know, paved the way for, I guess, Canada to become a state. So every time they breached that original agreement that we have with us, non-interference, which is don't govern us, we won't govern you, every time they breached that and imposed these laws such as the Indian Act, every time they tell us how to govern, they're breaking their own constitution. So they're basically, you know, breaking their own laws. So by having these chief and council follow their own rules, because these specific land claims, again, is a policy. The specific land claims policy is Canadian state's own biased rules, where we're not even representative in how to sit down and how we're going to settle these grievances. It's all their rules. They're the judge, jury, and prosecutor in the whole grievance. So, you know, they're not legitimate, these chiefs and councils. They're not accountable to us.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the whether there's even a legality to do away with these treaty rights, whether the land claims, you know, the legality of these land surrenders. But first, how would you describe the relationship between the leadership that's negotiating the extinguishment of these land rights and the broader people who belong to the Anishinaabeg Nation? How do you, you know, you've described that this principle of non-interference, which did you say derives from the Royal Proclamation of what, 1763 was it or something?
1764, there was the Niagara Covenant chain belt is an agreement that Sir William Johnson, he was a British military officer in Upper Canada, British Crown. So he, our uncle, he was Anishinaabe Pontiac, was going around with a confederacy of warriors or Shawnee or some Haudenosaunee people when that they're burning these forts. So the British were their military, their soldiers, you know, were preoccupied with like wars in France and stuff at the time. They couldn't keep up with the attacks that we were doing. So we were actually having a successful campaign and burning down their forts, occupying their forts. So came up with this peace agreement because, you know, they weren't upholding their agreements in the first place. That's why this campaign was happening with Pontiac. So, you know, he sent runners within our nation, sent them all over the place to gather them at Fort Niagara to attend a gathering of peace at Fort Niagara. So, you know, they saw that we were accustomed in solidifying agreements through the use of wampum. So in particular, they, Sir William Johnson, they developed an agreement where they utilized the idea of the two-row wampum, which was pretty influential with the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee people. Mm-hmm. They took that idea and they referenced it as a silver covenant chain where, you know, the silver is unbreakable. And sometimes that silver may become tarnished, and every so often we have to polish it, that tarnish that has occurred on that silver. So with that two-row idea, 24 nations came. And by nations, I don't mean First Nations or reserves, none of that. Us as sovereign nations, Mississauga, Shawnee, the Wendat, the Sauk, Fox, Anishinaabe, 24 nations showed up and agreed to this peace. And in exchange, we as Anishinaabe original people ended that crown, that two-row wampum belt, which is, again, based on peace and coexistence and non-interference. Mm-hmm. So again, with that breaches everything that these chiefs are doing. Again, there's before this agreement that we have with the Crown, we have intertribal agreements with each other where our spiritual leaders, we were just having a discussion about this last night and how we the words that we use when what we're doing right now today, we're repossessing our traditional territories, our area that we are used, that we're given by our creator. So, like, you know, we are of the earth. We don't own the earth. So how can we sell the earth and accept these settlement offers? That's one part, you know, that we've been taught from our spiritual leaders. Mm-hmm. And our intertribal agreements through the one dish, one spoon, we've come to agreements with the Haudenosaunee people and the people surrounding the Great Lakes, the many different nations around there, that we have acknowledged our use. We have equal rights to the resources, to our water and to the earth, and we have agreement that we won't take over each other's, you know, where we're occupying, where we're utilizing the earth, right? So we've come to agreement. So we have intertribal agreements before the crown, you know, for these chiefs who are given power from the Canadian state to deal with these settlement offers. They're forgetting who we are as nations. They're not. What happens in our area that we're using affects another person's area, what they're using. We have to sit down as a greater confederacy of people, sit down, and it's not just three band chiefs that can sit down and make these decisions. It's our whole, that's what unity is about. That's all these things that we talk about.
So would you say that this, the leadership that's negotiating this, is illegitimate in relation to the broader Anishinaabeg people and their society?
For damn sure, because, like, if we want to, you know, preach all these spiritual understandings of who we are, if we want to uphold these belts that Crown and First Nation gatherings, wampum belts, if we want to dance at powwows and do everything we say we are, then damn straight this is illegitimate, because, you know, otherwise we're just playing, I don't know, playing Indian. We're just dancing for the government, playing to their song and dance.
Yes, which they very much like, you know, just dancing. That's it seems like that's all they want of Aboriginal, what they call Aboriginal peoples, to become an ethnic group that, you know, kind of dance around to the tune of the Canadian government. Just as a matter of detail, how large is this land claim, this surrender that's in question right now, the Cold Waters Narrow land claim?
The one that's being negotiated, or has been negotiated, sorry, was only like 10,000 square acres along Highway 12 in Simcoe Coldwater area. But I think the actual area where Collins Treaty is, that was actually like 650,000 square acres or something like that. So, like, what the people, the researchers or whatever have not pulled forth the actual amount of land, I guess you want to say.
Mm-hmm. They did it in stages. Yeah. Like, they're dealing with the Coldwater Narrows land claim settlement. So a little bit of history of that is, again, we have to talk about, like, the historic facts of what happened. You know, that area in which we are situated is not our traditional Anishinaabeg area. Is the land of the Wendat Nation.
Yeah.
And how we come to occupy that is, you know, our brothers and sisters who are now allies, friendship, who we have agreements now, the Haudenosaunee, for reasons that I suggest that other people go and find out for themselves. Mm. We're coming to attack the Wendat, and they slowly came up into Three Fires Confederacy area, and some believe that it was in fact due to the Jesuits and what they were doing at that time to try and divide our people's friendship. So what had happened is, like, the Wendat were our allies, and, you know, the Seneca and the Mohawk peoples were coming to the Three Fires area, like north of Lake Superior. So we came down, we kind of pushed them down south, back to their homelands, which was on the southern part of Lake Ontario. Mm-hmm. So that's how we became our people in that area, protecting that eastern door of our territory. We're still there now, defending it through the use of what we're doing right now. So, you know, that was in the 1600s. So in the 1700s, we became allies with the British, and a lot of our warriors, you know, with that peace belt, a lot of our warriors, a lot of, you know, our great-grandfathers, we went with Tecumseh and we defended that border from those American colonists. Well, that's because we were allies. We uphold our alliance with the British Crown. In the 1700s, we established the Collins Treaty, which was not a land transaction. It was an agreement to allow the British to have access to Georgian Bay to come up to Fort Michilimackinac, use, like, that Lake Huron area. So we allowed them to come in through, like, what is known as Barrie now, Barrie, Ontario, like through Trudeau and all that way, and the lock system to develop a military road. They were supposed to give us our communities around that area, like the chief at that time. The hereditary chiefs agreed to that, and we were supposed to get, like, a blacksmith and a new wardrobe every year. And after the war campaign, they were supposed to return these lands. Which they didn't. So it was in a process that they took this away, and that was Central Ontario. So
and then from there, they only slowly and continuously colonized the land and encroached on your territory. So, you know, just so as so that our audience, maybe not too familiar with this particular case, doesn't think that this is all history. What impact has this colonization project had on the Anishinaabe people? In the present day, like, what is the state of the nation? Where are people residing? What have been the effects of this colonialism?
Well, again, we have no economy, right? You know, like, our total way of life has been prevented, can't utilize. We can't even make a dollar, man. Like, even our cigarettes, our tobacco, we can't even, you know, that's imposed on us, all these taxes and everything. Anything we do to try and, you know, assert sovereignty or anything that, you know, just try to live and survive is, you know, illegal.
But I think that the colonial policies have affected people differently. Like, for example, for myself, I mean, like, I don't speak my language. I don't know how to hunt. I don't know how to fish or trap. You know, like, I don't know too many ceremonies. Like, so it wasn't until years afterwards that I was able to, like, sort of find my own path and find my way back to the Anishinaabe culture. So, like, for a lot of different people, like, Johnny himself, like, he carries a lot of this knowledge and stuff, and whereas I don't. So, like, it affects a lot of people differently, I guess, depending on which household you would have grown up in.
Yeah.
But colonial aspects are very, like, prevalent today. Like, you know, like, the drinking and drugging and the alcohol and, the, you know, like, all these behaviors that are like, suicide and,
yeah,
and, you know, like, abuse and of all kinds of all sorts are all byproducts of colonialism.
And so given this and given also what Johnny identified as, you know, the destruction of the economic foundation of the nation over hundreds of years of colonialism, what would you say to the argument that, you know, this land claim settlement is the best possible thing for the Anishinaabe people to get this $307 million? I was particularly taken aback by, you know, the government website, which said that, First Nations people can certainly buy back the land and turn it into a reserve if they want. And I was saying to myself, 10,000 acres of land with $307 million, I don't know how much of that could be bought back. But so what would you say is the way forward then in terms of, you know, restoring and asserting Anishinaabe nationhood, given the extensive effects of colonialism on the people?
Well, again, like, a lot of our, like, peers and people who even support us say, you know, you can't go live in the bush. You know, a lot of people are not ready to drop everything they're dependent upon, which is, like, all this mainstream, I'm going to say, junk that keeps us preoccupied and keeps us tied into the machine that further destroys our planet. So, like, it's all in that belt, because that belt talks about non-interference, peace, and coexistence. You know, if we don't own the earth, then, you know, there's ways that we can work, live together, which is based on peace, coexistence, non-interference. So with that, you know, basically going, working with people who, you know, work together.
From my own point of view, because I was, you know, raised assimilated, and once I really understood and found out what Anishinaabe means, well, like, what it meant to me, like, as a person, and how I would fit into a community, and how, like, this land surrender came about, and how it was, like, going to be the extinguishment of our people. Like, for me, what that means is that we actually have to go back and we have to decolonize. And by decolonize, I mean, like, that we have to actually, like, reject all of these colonial practices.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's not going to be just, like, one giant step where we're all just going to emancipate one day, go move into the bush. But, I guess it starts off with, like, a few small groups of people that go and do this, and then people start to generate interest and they want to come back, right? Like, I don't want to say that everybody's a sellout, but, I mean, like, there are lots of people that are, like, you know, like, solid in these traditional ways, and
we're
up here, like, uniting with some of these people so that we can learn this knowledge for ourselves and unite with some of these people that are like-minded, so that we can actually, you know, go and do these things, you know, and make places. So, like, for me, like, you know, it's like rejecting these policies, rejecting these claims, and going actually back onto the traditional lands and just living there, and just, like, you know, this is the way that I want to live. It's, you know, it's granted to me by the Creator. You know, it's granted to me by the Tuvalu Wampums. I mean, so, like, I'm just going to go out and do it and live like this. So, like, that's the way that I foresee things.
Like, just to add to, to be a nation, we have to have, like, that relationship with the land base, right? And right now, I'm still processing a thought that I've just been reminded of last night, how we are of the earth, you know, we don't own the earth. But at the same time, you know, like, you look at those wolves and those bears, you know, they protect their territory. They have a right to that territory just as much as we do, but we coexist together. We do not try to exterminate those bears or wolves or take away what they have every right to. So, You know, to be a nation, we have to have that relationship with our earth to be able to feed ourselves. So to be a nation, we have to feed our people. We have to have that land base. Again, what happens with these land claim settlements offers, you're giving away, you're signing your title away to your land base.
Yeah.
So you're basically saying, okay, I'll be forever dependent on the one who's giving me the money. And once that money runs out, you're not going to have land. You know, in majority of these cases, this is not only our fight. This goes across, you know, across Turtle Island.
Yes.
It goes across, you know, all the globally, right? Because, you know, Canadian citizens, American citizens, they're the new Indian. He's been practiced upon us. So, you know, like, we have to unite, you know, to work together in peace, coexistence, and non-interference together. But those who want to work together, you know, have that dream of, you know, working together and living in coexistence with Earth. But again, like, back to your question, it's like, you have to, you know, we have that relationship with our mother to provide for ourselves. We can't sell the land, the title that we you know, can't surrender our relationship with our mother, man.
And what has been the effects? Have you observed what the effects have been of other First Nations peoples who have received some of the settlement money on the nation as a whole and on the individuals who have received that cash, given the state of many Indigenous communities through hundreds of years of colonialism? Have you, do you have any observations or thoughts on what the effects of that money has been?
Well, again, like, it goes through, like, compensation with residential schools. Like, when you throw money at stuff, you know, like, in my eyes, it just kind of adds fuel to the fire, so to speak, because you see, a lot of our people have been affected through colonization, which is demonstrated through what Richard was saying, drug abuse, alcohol, suicide. Mm-hmm. So when you're throwing money at a situation where people have been affected with, you know, all these sorts of, you know, demonstrate these colonial behaviors, you know, it's just adding fuel to the fire. So, like, you know, all these corporations who polluted lands and all these communities who are receiving compensation packages, residential school survivors who are packages, in my eyes, I'll take the brunt of it. I see a lot of, you know, continuation of addictions going on. You know, I've heard stories where, like, people lost like $200,000 with their compensation bucks. You just blew it in a month, you know, and that's going back right to cash. And these land claim settlement offers, if we want to purchase our land back, we have to do it. Yeah, do it from private landowners. Sometimes we won't even see what was taken away from us.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
What we, since our economy, our right to have an economy, is such, there's so many laws attacked on us where it's illegal for us to make a buck and survive and develop our own economy.
Yeah.
You know, we're putting back those dollars they give us back into their economy,
exactly,
their society, which, you know, furthers, you know, destruction of our planet and a continuation of this machine that's destroying us all.
Certainly. It's the policy taken by colonialism and imperialism all across the world, right?
Yeah.
Countries are not allowed to develop, you know, what are called third world countries are not allowed to develop their own economies, their own industry. Instead, you know, wars are waged just so at the end of the day, they can take a loan from the IMF and be dependent on international capitalism, right?
Definitely. At the same time, specifically with land claim surrenders, land is not was all that was taken away in these land claim settlement offers. What these Indian chiefs are accepting, they're accepting these compensation packages, which was the loss of assets.
Yeah.
And the land, but at the same time, that's not what was all that was taken away.
Yeah.
Majority of these times, by the theft of these land, has allowed for these colonial policies, such as the Indian Act, to start being imposed on us. So at the same time, in these packages, in these specific land claims policies, there should be some agreement where they relinquish the Indian Act and all these policies that affect us. They should relinquish all those illegal laws that have been enforced on us, because they took away, you know, I don't want to say they've taken away, because there are still some of us throughout the decades and centuries who've been asserting and standing up and fighting for our sovereignty, but there's nothing in there that says, okay, we're doing away with the Indian Act, because they took away our right to be our own people and nation too, with those lands.
So just in terms of the immediate way forward, we have just a minute left for the interview. What steps will you be taking to try to continue protesting this settlement and rebuilding the Anishinaabeg Nation?
Again, we're just, like, getting to as many communities as we can to, like, look for those people who want to work together. Not only our people, you know, like I was saying before, Canadian citizens, American citizens are the new Indians. We need to, you know, work together with people who are like-minded to stand up to against this enemy, which I call the Wendigo. Wendigos, man, these people who never end, that want to see the destruction of the earth and the earth people. So it's just asserting our way of life and living our way of life.
And Richard, any final thoughts for you?
I guess we're just going to continue working and doing the exact same things that we're doing, and, you know, going through different communities and letting them know, like, what's going on in our area, because this is an agenda, it's in a policy that the corporate state of Canada is doing to buy back all the land, so that there's no uprising, there's no one there to speak up for the land, so they can just go and take over the land and pollute it and destroy it and whatnot. So so we need to we need to get into these communities and to educate the children and let them know what's really going on in the world.
Well, Richard Peters, Johnny Hawk, thank you so much for being on the Radio Basics. We'll continue to follow the story and the struggle, continue to support, and we look forward to having you on sometime again in the near future.
Jimmy Glitch.
All right, brothers, thank you. That was Johnny Hawk and Richard Peters, two Anishinaabeg men who are protesting the Coldwater Narrows land claim surrender that the leadership that is subject to Canadian colonialism has been negotiating with the Canadian government. Here on Radio Basics on CHOY 105.5 FM.